Welcome to this edition of Buy Hold Sell, brought to you by Livewire Markets, Australia's number one website for expert investment analysis. Buy Hold Sell is a weekly show where two fund managers share their views on a selection of listed companies in their area of expertise. Buyers and sellers are what make the market, and you'll find that our guests don't always agree on the stocks being covered. Hit the subscribe button on your podcast player to be the first to receive new episodes each week. If there are stocks you'd like our guests to discuss, let us know by leaving a comment in the review segment. Remember, the views expressed in this show are not recommendations to invest. You should seek appropriate investment advice before making any investment decisions. And of course, please read the disclaimer in the show's notes. Let's get into the show.
Welcome to this special thematic episode of Livewire's Buy, Hold, Sell. It's part of our 2021 income series, Solving the Income Puzzle. My name is James Marley. I'm a co-founder of Livewire Markets. And today I'm doing something a little bit different. Rather than getting the fundies on the hook, I've got two superb financial advisors that know all things creating income portfolios. They've answered every question you could possibly have. So I'm joined by Charlie Viola from Pitcher Partners and Hugh Robertson from Centaur, joining us from the Gold Coast. Lucky Hugh. All right, I'm going to start with a contentious issue. How much do people really need to retire? What's the magic number that comes up? There's industry research that says $640,000, which seems awfully precise to me. Charlie, I'm going to hit you with this one first. How do people think about the right amount that they need to retire off?
Oh, look, James, I think it's, one has to question what that number is actually based on, to be honest. So I think everybody's lifestyle is their own. I would argue that everybody needs, certainly in the first 5 to 8 years of retirement, probably 100% of your pre-retirement discretionary income to live off. After 10 or 12 years of retirement, then naturally your expenses are probably going to fall away. But I would suggest that any portfolio needs to be big enough and sufficient enough to generate, because when you've got plenty of time on your hands, what do? You spend money. If you think you can go from earning or spending 100 or 120,000 while you're working to living off, 40 or 50,000 in retirement, that's just irrational in my view.
Hugh, have you got something to add to that? Is there a magic number that you speak to clients about?
I think the majority of people, it's a good starting point, this number, to start to try and gauge what retirement actually looks like for them. Charlie's spot on when we talk about a U-shaped spending pattern in retirement. The first 10 years are the most important, years of their retirement, certainly where they're going to be the most active and they're going to travel the most. So I think in years, there's certainly a higher expenditure need there. We often joke that the next decade is about, cups of tea and babysitting. And the last decade's important because we need money for healthcare. So I think that as for retirement standard is a good starting point for the majority of people. However, that's all it is. It's just a starting point. And from there, they can go on and try and create their own, look at the budgets if they want to try and decipher what retirement actually looks like. I think that's more the conversation people need to have. What does their retirement look like to them?
Well, it's a good point because it segues into my next question. When do people start switching, or how do you, people that are accumulating in growth phase, a lot of people, myself in my early 40s, haven't really thought about retirement just yet. When does it need to start factoring into your planning? When do people start thinking about that switch?
You're probably about 5 years out. Ideally, we'd love people to start 20 years out. However, in terms of a portfolio and allocations, in terms of what you do with reinvesting income versus paying to cash to build up enough money for your retirement income, in terms of what you do with your contribution strategies, I feel that around 5 years is probably what the rule of thumb is with most people. And that way it also can, a lot of people might be in second marriages, a lot of people might be paying off debt still. So there's a conversation around debt versus salary sacrifice contributions. So there's some really meaningful points that could make a really big difference for your retirement nest egg 5 years and beyond out from retirement.
Charlie, what about you in terms of a runway for people having a successful retirement? What's the the time frame that you like to see?
Yeah, I sort of agree with Hugh that I think the planning process is a reasonably long one. You know, it's a 5 or 6 year process so that people can really understand what they think they're going to spend in retirement, what retirement will look like. What I counsel everybody, and to Hugh's salient point there, liquidity becomes really important in retirement, you know, being able to get your hands on the money, because you really don't know what retirement holds, right? You've never done it before. It's not going to be linear. Some years are going to be, you'll spend more than others. Again, though, what I counsel everybody, though, is that even when you're retired, your investment time horizon is 25 or 30 years plus.
Yeah.
So, right? Which means that, you know, pulling all the money out of growth assets and sticking them into defensive assets is mental. It's just not the thing to do. Growth assets will still produce the best return, and it's going to produce the best long-term income streams. Therefore, you really still need to be invested with that really long-term time horizon attached to it.
I think we all want to have a solid nest egg. I'd say even though retirement seems a long way away for me, I still have in the back of my head ticking away, how am I going to get that number up so that I can, you know, do some trips and all that sort of stuff, support my kids. What are two tips, Charlie, and I'll start with you, top two tips that can have a big impact for people getting ready for that nest egg to maximize it?
Oh, can I have three, James? We've got three.
Take three.
The first one is start earlier. The second one is buy more risk assets. Risk assets are those assets that are going to generate the better return over time. And the third one is everybody should be using their balance sheet. So use the balance sheet that's available to you in your own situation so that you can grow your wealth properly. You know, putting $1 on $1 in a bank account is just never going to get you to the point where you can have the retirement that you want, unless you're one of those, you know, very fortunate people like you, maybe, James, who are earning a couple of $1 million a year.
I'm sending my application to be one of your clients next week, Charlie. Hugh, Charlie's given us 3 points. Is it possible you could stick to the script and give us two, or do you need a bit extra?
We'll see. I'll just expand on my points. I think from Charlie's comments before too, is to stay in growth assets. You should be leaving 60-70% in risk assets, growth assets through retirement. And that's really to counteract your longevity risk. We're probably going to live a lot longer than we expect to, or certainly than the previous generations did. And also inflation risk, you know, although this is such a conversation point right now, but long-term, we know the price of everything goes up, especially healthcare-related things. So growth assets to counteract those two risks. The second tip would be around sequencing risk. So from my perspective would be having enough cash set aside for maybe year one, year two, and even maybe year three of retirement, but really not a lot more sitting in cash than that. If you've got some large expenses coming up, great, money for that. But you've still got to have a really good balanced portfolio throughout the retirement. I think, and Charlie would, I'm assuming, would agree with this, after the last 12 months, that was what we really saw. People saw the value in having a well-diversified balanced portfolio away from just term deposits or just growth assets wholly.
So Hugh, just on that point about having some liquidity, you're talking about having something to tide you through those first few years of retirement so that if there is a drawdown in growth assets, it's got time to come back. Is that what you're talking about?
Spot on. I didn't want to use the third tip, but yep, exactly right. Because the challenge there is, think about a year like last year with COVID. We don't want our clients to have to sell down their equities portion of their portfolio when there's volatility that really, you know, it was an unprecedented year, but the recovery was great. So you didn't want to have to sell CBA shares at 50 if you didn't need to. So by having some cash set aside, you were okay to get through that dip. I think if you look at the long-term numbers, from peak to trough, the market's been negative for about 5 years, 10 months is the worst period ever. So with distributions and some cash reserves, most retirees can get through while still having a good allocation of growth assets. Would you agree, Charlie?
Yeah, I do. And to that point, you know, I'm of the view that cash is really only an asset that's sitting there waiting to be invested in something else, to be honest. So, you know, I'm a big one for growth assets. It's what's going to drive returns. It's what's going to drive income. And people should look at the risk in their portfolio around the risk of impairment, not the risk of volatility. You know, remember, these timeframes are 30 and 35 years long. So volatility is going to happen. Let's just worry about the risk of impairment and not buy assets that become impaired.
Charlie, I'm just going to hit you with a follow-up question on that comment you made around using your balance sheet. When I hear those sorts of terms, immediately my head springs to maybe using some gearing or some leverage, but I'm keen for you just to give me a little bit more detail on what you mean by using your full balance sheet.
Yeah, so everybody's situation is their own, and everybody's risk profile and you know, attitude to risk and you know, appetite for risk will be certainly be different. But I'm certainly a big one that if you have got a really strong balance sheet, you're in a great job, you're generating more income than you need, then taking on gearing, using your balance sheet, you know, using the equity in your home to help you build wealth is a good way to do it.
All right. You've also been asked to bring along a common mistake that you see people making that you think you can help our readers avoid, a couple of potholes. Hugh, let's start with you. What's something that you see investors consistently get wrong that you can help out by calling out?
Opportunity costs by having too much in cash is a big one from my point of view. They think that cash is safe, and probably the theme of both what Charlie and I are talking about is that cash actually isn't safe. In a real return after tax, after inflation, you're usually, in this current environment, you're definitely losing money. And so kind of working to a plan and really going through what your goals are to evaluate what level of risk you need to undertake to reach your goals, because share market volatility isn't the risk that we see. We see not hitting your goals as the risk. So I'm with Charlie in terms of the previous comment as well on, you know, using equity can be a smart strategy with professional guidance. So for me, it's just the opportunity cost, especially early on when you could get compound returns and start getting that snowball working for you earlier. So that would be the big thing that I've seen. If I see clients that have regret, it's typically that they didn't invest earlier.
Okay, great. Charlie, what's your tip? What's the common mistake that you see people making?
Look, I think the common mistake that some retirees make is certainly, and we've hit on this a few times, is thinking that just because they're in retirement, that life's, you know, pretty much over and they've got to hold everything in defensive assets. People need to remember that those timeframes are really long. The other piece is make sure any asset that you ever buy meets the quality matrix. You know, make sure that any asset that you ever buy fundamentally has got, three things that are attached to it. One, has an ability to produce income. Two, there's a low chance it's going to blow up, so that risk of impairment becomes a big one. And thirdly, we want to see assets grow over time, because that's what's going to protect the buying power of money over the long term. Again, retirees shouldn't be looking at their portfolio and thinking, hey, I've got to have 50 or 60 or 70 or 90% of this money sitting in defensive assets, because what happens if the market turns, or, you know, I'm not going to be able to earn it back? Remember, you've got 25 or 30 years of investment to go.
Now, listen, the next question was going to be about the must-have asset class, but I'm going to skip over that and bring us straight to your portfolios and ask you for the first asset class picked in your portfolio. That's going to be your star player. But I guess, Charlie, I'll get your portfolio up first. My first question to you is just on return expectations. We actually haven't talked about it. What sort of expectations do you set for your clients? And if we bring that portfolio up, you can see 50 to 60% in shares, 15% hard assets, 10% in quality private debt, 10% fixed income, 5% in pure alternative and smaller caps, and some cash, which you've said to deploy elsewhere. So hit me with that return target and maybe talk me through your team.
Yeah, so certainly what we say to everybody is that a good quality balanced portfolio with a mix such as this, our medium to long-term expectations are sort of 7 to 9 to 10% annually, of which probably half of that's going to be income. We're a big one for showing the client their revenue production over time, and even the way that we report to them is, what was the revenue last year? What do we expect the revenue to be this year from each and every asset, and what is it total to at the bottom? We're of the view, I guess, that capital growth will be whatever it will be, you know, depending upon equity markets. But the bit that we can control is the revenue production. So we really want every portfolio to be punching out 4 or 5% of income annually, which is why, I guess, we've always got a reasonable percentage to, you know, those hard assets and sort of the quality private debt and private syndicate style investments. But the key driver of virtually every portfolio, and we're probably no different to anybody else, will be equities. It'll be large cap, good quality, defensive, blue chip equities, where we know what the business does, we know where the revenue comes from, we know how it makes profit, We know what their market is. We know what their market share is. You know, we know that it can gobble up its competitors. We want to generate revenue for the clients because ultimately that's what they're going to live off, is the revenue that their portfolio is producing.
Charlie, could you tell me a little bit about this fixed interest, these short duration bonds? Because I know if you're sort of stepping out of cash, which is sort of negative real return at the moment, and people being forced out of it, with, you know, I'm imagining those short duration bonds is kind of the next step along from that. What's the role of that asset class in the portfolio?
So we probably use those short duration bonds where you're probably looking for 100 or 150 over cash, very much as somewhat as a cash alternative. We make it clear to clients it's not cash. You know, there's some risk attached to it. But rather than sitting that, you know, that 2 or 3 year term money that kind of Hugh talked about previously, we agree with that. We think the clients need to have access to that capital. If the roof falls in or the kids get sick or their kids want to buy a house or they want to buy a new car in retirement, we do actually want to have a level of liquidity. We think those short duration bonds or those cash enhanced style strategies are a good place to park some money for a short period of time until you're either utilizing it for that purpose or there's an opportunity to go invest in something that's a little more meaningful and a little more long term.
Mm-hmm. All righty, just a final point, 10% cash. I mean, you've said that that's sort of a tactical allocation.
Yeah, I think in reality, you know, that's an absolute maximum and it's really money that's sitting there waiting to be invested in something else. We're a big one for trying to help the clients find weaknesses in market or find opportunities that exist, whether it's in alternates or it's just in general risk assets. We always want to have a little bit of powder dry in the client situation so that we can take advantage. So, you know, during the COVID period last year, we actually did a fair bit of buying through that period because we saw a lot of those good quality companies that we really like and just general equities that we could kind of buy in and really fix our return at least for a period of time from those assets. So it'll wax and wane, right? Like these things are never exact because, you know, our equity allocations would have gone up over the last 3 years because equity market's gone up 35% or whatever it is over that time frame. And we're not a big one for rebalancing. But, you know, as the money generates its own cash, we want to make sure we deploy that cash in the right way over a period of time.
Thanks very much for that, Charlie. Really appreciate the detail there. Hugh, your turn in the hot seat. I'm going to give people a quick run through what they can see on the screen. You've got a 60% allocation to equities between, you know, domestic and globals, 15% real return strategies, which I'm going to get you to tell us what's under the lid there, 12% alternatives, 6 in bonds and some cash as well, small allocation to cash. Talk us through how you think about that portfolio and maybe you could hit that same question on return targets that I sent to Charlie.
Similar in terms of how Charlie's view of it, 7 to 9%, that sort of keeps the clients at around a 5% drawdown after inflation and fairly low levels of risk there in the way that we draw down from, you know, the cash, sort of like a ladder of risk from where we draw down. Then going from there, 4% income, some franking credit benefit there. So we feel that that's still conservative, still achievable in this world. Equities being the main driver for us. Aussie on the dividend and franking credit and global for growth to keep pace with inflation. The probably similar to Charlie on short duration bonds, alternatives there I've got as an allocation, that's alternative fixed income strategies. So we're looking at different ways of managing fixed income risk there. So that can be called, you know, unconstrained bond funds that have the ability to shorten or lengthen duration and sort of arbitrage their way through to reduce risk in that space, especially if interest rates rise, that there could be some issues. The real return strategies is really around 4 key things: return seeking, diversifying opportunities, portfolio protection, and inflation hedge. So utilizing something like that via way of an investment fund of sorts so that it's dynamic by nature. So if things are rather, if I think about the do-it-yourself investor, they might have a somewhat static portfolio and not look to do a lot of changes. So you're going to need some dynamic asset allocation capabilities within your own personal portfolio. Obviously, you know, Charlie mentioned it last year and we did the same thing. We were buying in the lows last year because we had conviction. We understood what was happening. So we can do that, you know, regular quarterly rebalancing of portfolios. We can do all those things. But I think for the do-it-yourself investor or maybe the self-directed investor, they can really benefit from having some of those real return strategies that can really push it. They don't have a set asset allocation. It's dynamic by nature. So they can really move the needle of to more or less risk with the number one goal always being to protect your capital.
So just specifically on those, when you talk about those real return strategies, are these long short funds, market neutral funds, or are these the diverse, those really diversified real return that are sort of inflation plus style targets?
Yeah, so the majority, they've really come to, we might remember prior to the GFC, there wasn't much of this as an investment option. And after the GFC, we had a really rough run in investment markets, but we've got an aging population that wants to draw down, you know, their income for retirement. So from that perspective, it's given rise to these real return funds, which might be a CPI plus five or CPI plus three, CPI plus seven. But I think they warrant a place in people's portfolios where, you know, the manager can do the heavy lifting on that for you. And there's starting to be a number of providers in the marketplace now that can do that, certainly.
Okay, great. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that wraps up a look under the bonnet at these two portfolios that that Charlie and Hugh have brought along for us today. I hope you really enjoyed the transparency that they've provided on their allocation. And remember, subscribe to our YouTube channel.
Thanks for listening to Buy, Hold, Sell, brought to you by Livewire Markets, Australia's number one source of expert investment analysis. Register for free at livewiremarkets.com to discover more exclusive investing articles, videos, and podcasts.